starts facing enormous personal and intellectual dilemmas. Just what did emancipation mean? Where was the stricken, devastated nation headed? Where in history, philosophy, or prophecy could he find guideposts to help shape a new national order? Would the freed slaves achieve civil and political rights, and would they be protected by the government that had helped to free them? What's more, how would the drum-beating war propagandist, visionary of an apocalyptic struggle for black freedom and the destruction of white slaveholder civilization, convert overnight into new roles and vacations? What would he do after abolition? What would his soldier veteran sons do with their lives? How would he, the family patriarch, support his extended and growing network of kinfolk? What would become of a troubled marriage now that all of Anna and Frederick's children were adults starting their own families? Douglas had ceased editing his newspaper in August 1863. That professional emotional stem of his life for 16 years as a radical abolitionist. Although many others had earned the label, no African American had taken on the mantle of leader quite like Douglas. That leadership had been rooted in the power of words. How would he now employ his incomparable voice? Who would be listening? If you have been the scorned outsider, what do you do if the door opens and they let you take the first steps inside? What does a radical reformer do if his cause triumphs? In Life and Times, in 1881, while reflecting back on the immediate aftermath of the war, Douglas admitted that a strange and perhaps perverse feeling came over me. Great joy over the ending of slavery was at times tinged with a feeling of sadness. I felt that I had reached the end of the noblest and best part of my life. My school was broken up, my church disbanded, and the beloved congregation dispersed, never to come together again. Anti-slavery had performed its work. Its leaders no longer had the society's attention. The huge audiences might never come back. The endless calls to lecture might cease. So Douglas drew from a scene in a Shakespeare tragedy to express his memory of that moment. Othello's occupation was gone. For a few years, he would struggle with this sense of personal displacement and fear of irrelevance. Othello was the Moor of Venice, who was in love with a white woman, and a powerful man losing his bearings. Douglas surely read the text of the play and felt an affinity for its sense of lost authority and professional purpose. He was amply aware that in comparing himself to Othello, he invoked one of the most potent symbols of racial and sexual mores in Western culture. Shakespeare's original Othello was of noble royal origin, a former general of great battlefield achievement, and black. He marries the beautiful young Venetian woman Desdemona. Iago, who has been to the wars with Othello, is a trusted friend. The central drama, however, is how Iago, in reality, is the coy, vile villain, hates Othello, and slowly renders him distressed and confused, then finally poisoned by jealousy and murderous revenge because of Desdemona's alleged infidelity with Cassio. Unaware of Desdemona's innocence and Iago's perfidy, the fated Othello kills his wife on her bed, and after the horrible, twisted discovery of the truth, kills himself as the confessed fool, and is cursed by others as the damned slave. In the 18th and early 19th centuries, moral questions about the passion of jealousy, betrayal, or a woman's alluring nature informed American reactions to Othello. But by the antebellum era, the Moor's color and the matter of interracial marriage dominated the meaning of the play. From the 1820s, Othello was still widely staged, including in the South, but the lead character was increasingly lightened, even whitened or portrayed as tan or as a slightly swarthy American Indian. The sooty Moor would no longer play for racist American audiences, even in the North. If Othello appeared as a mulatto or an octoroon, as he quite often did in these highly racialized times, the lesson most Americans took was that whites and blacks ought never to mix. In May 1869, at the brand new Edwin Booth Theater in New York, Douglas attended a performance of Othello with Ottilie Assing and a group of her German friends, with the famous Booth, the assassin's brother, in the lead role. We do not have Douglas's reaction to the night at the theater, but Ossing called it a magnificent evening, where we saw an amazingly beautiful performance of Othello. She thought Booth a splendid Othello. Booth recrafted and produced his own Othello, published that year and premiered in his splendid new theater, complete with frescoed ceiling and statuary at 23rd Street and 6th Avenue. The play Frederick and Ottilie saw was Booth's own. He had performed Othello for 2 decades by then, with his character wearing glittering Persian gowns, a purple and gold turban, speaking in a genteel, formal manner, and thoroughly purged of any taint of blackness. He was exotic and charismatic, but certainly no longer the African with a violent warlike history, craving and possessing the white aristocrat's daughter. Some lines that explicitly invoked race were even expunged from Booth's text. Whatever endured in Douglas's mind and memory from that 1869 evening of seeing Booth's Othello, all we know is that he turned to the noble Moor's anguished soliloquy about lost masculine dignity and mental collapse as Douglas remembered his own professional and personal displacement in the wake of the Civil War. What sense had I of her stolen hours of lust? I sought not, thought it not, it harmed not me. He that is robbed, not wanting what is stolen, let him not know it, and he's not robbed at all. I had been happy if the general camp, pioneers and all, had tasted her sweet body. So I had nothing known. Oh, now forever, farewell the tranquil mind, farewell content. Farewell the plumed troop and the big wars that make ambition virtue. Oh, farewell, farewell the neighing steed and the shrill trump, the spirit-stirring drum, the ear-piercing fife, the royal banner and all quality, pride, pomp, and circumstance of glorious war. Farewell. Othello's occupation is gone. It is possible that, like many other Americans, Douglas loved Shakespeare as much for the rhetoric and oratory as for the literature. But he could not have read Othello without reflecting on its deep probings of the ideas of trust, fate, status inside or out of the state, human evil, and interracial relationships. Douglas may have been saying farewell to his big wars in the late 1860s as well, but endless smaller ones in his public and private life had only begun. In the early Reconstruction years, Douglas did consider a variety of career and personal options. In 1865 to 66, feeling in flux, he may at least briefly have contemplated an old urge to retreat to a life of farming if he could secure the right land. It is doubtful that he entertained such an idea for long. In Rochester, among Amy Post's correspondents, emerged the rumor that Douglas was planning to move to New Jersey to be with Ossing. Salmon Chase, among others, invited Douglas to relocate to Alexandria, Virginia, to edit a new paper, to which he responded that he had no desire to court violence or martyrdom by going to the former slave state. He did apparently have new Baltimore dreams, and gave some thought to moving to the town from which he had escaped from slavery. As the war ended in spring of 1865, Douglas confided as much to Julia Crofts in England, who still devotedly raised money and sent it to her old friend for Freedmen's Aid. In other letters, he admitted his desire to meet Thomas Auld again. And more important, he had already experienced a hero's welcome in Baltimore, and would again in September. Along with his sons, he may have imagined business opportunities in the post-war port city with a large black population. So worried was Crofts about Douglas's plans that she begged him not to move. "Pray, very dear friend, stay in the northern states and leave Baltimore an untried field of labor. Do not throw your valuable life away venturing near the old house. Think of realities and let those romantic visions remain in abeyance." She believed Douglas would be a marked man in Baltimore or anywhere in the South, and pleaded with him not to even visit for lectures in the city of his slave youth. Indeed, Julia had reason to worry. In the wake of Douglas's speeches in Baltimore in late 1864 or early 1865, an Augusta, Georgia newspaper reported on his performance. This saucy Negro, one of the representative men of the North, delivered the subjoined address at Baltimore. Poor old Maryland. She has had bitter pills enough, but here is something in the way of a black draft. So constant was Douglas's advocacy for black suffrage, and so eager was he for some kind of foothold inside power, that any withdrawal to a quiet life or a long-term adventure in Europe with Ossing was never his desire. After the war, Douglas still wanted to affect history and not be merely one of its symbols. In May 1865, the Black Draft joined his old friends and rivals at the 32nd anniversary meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society in New York. The society engaged in an intense dispute over whether to disband in the wake of emancipation, to declare victory and fold its tent. Garrison, backed by a few loyalists, led the effort for dismemberment, declaring it an absurdity to maintain an anti-slavery society after slavery is dead. But Wendell Phillips led a larger faction, outvoting Garrison 118-48, and urging the society to work for black civil and political rights. Called on to speak, Douglas reflected with nostalgia on his first years out on the circuit with the old Garrisonians, but committed himself to the much good anti-slavery work yet to be done. He made an especially forceful case for the right to vote. "Slavery is not abolished until the black man has the ballot," Douglas asserted. As long as the word white could be inserted or even implied in new southern state constitutions, abolitionists had not lost their occupation. "Stay the course of faith and devotion," Douglas counseled, quoting Exodus when Moses pleads with the people to believe that God will yet save them from the Egyptians. "Stand still and see the salvation of God." With Moses in the original Exodus, Douglas asked his audience for an almost unattainable faith. "Believe," he exhorted, "God's promise. The Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them no more forever." But he urged against any naive trust of their former enemies in the pro-slavery South. "Think you that because they are for a moment in the talons and the beak of our glorious eagle, instead of the slave being there, as formerly, that they are converted?" Abolitionists, Douglas argued, had better wait and see what new form this old monster will assume. By September, Douglas was back in Baltimore for a special occasion, the dedication of a Douglas Institute, a cultural educational enterprise founded in a building of the former Newton University. The structure on East Lexington Street, occupied by 800 people at Douglas's address, had been appropriated by the U.S. Army as a hospital during the war. For this, yet another extraordinary homecoming to Baltimore, Douglas crafted a beautiful address about the nature of education, civilization, and lives characterized by pursuits of the mind and soul, and not merely by laborer's brawn. From a man with no formal schooling, it was a moving embrace of intellect, as well as an astute analysis of the history of racism. In an effort both sobering and hopeful, Douglas rejoiced in having his name associated with such a first. That blacks had rallied with some white benefactors to create an educational effort such as this was a first sign of rain after a famine, the first sign of peace after 10,000 calamities. Douglas spoke in personal as well as collective terms of learning and overcoming the chains of ignorance imposed by centuries of slavery. That black people had been shut out for ages from the arts, from science, and from all the more elevating forms of industry, or the higher wants and aspirations of the human soul, was, Douglas believed, a great fact of their history. Hence, this new beginning was a sacred act of human striving. Douglas wished that separate black schools and associations were not necessary, but he accepted their reality and used them as the source of a brilliant critique of racism. Black representative, distinguished men were always considered exceptions, Douglas complained. Claims of black racial inferiority had over time been met with historical arguments about the achievements of ancient African civilizations in Ethiopia and Egypt, or in the modern revolution in Haiti. Moreover, even pointing to the three centuries in which Christendom had summoned heaven and hell enforcing African peoples through the cruel filter of the slave trade, had not converted the growing ranks of racial theorists. "Our history has been but a track of blood," said Douglas, "and mankind lost sight of our human nature in the idea of being property." He then lamented, as he celebrated, that black soldiers in the Civil War had proven at least one element of civilization, manly courage, that we love our country, and that we will fight for an idea. White civilization, Douglas argued, had for too long denied black people the fundamental element separating humans from all other animals. Consciousness, the capacity to discern, write, and transmit history. Douglas asserted for his people the same powers of all other men. "He learns from the past, improves upon the past, looks back upon the past, and hands down his knowledge of the past to after-coming generations." The former slave, with no degrees, wanted any such school as the Douglas Institute to be a place from which enlightenment and refinement in all their forms shall flow as a river, enriching, ennobling, strengthening, and purifying all who will lave in its waters. In such an assessment of what it meant to be human, Douglas sang out a kind of freedman's dream, as he also showed that he had found at least a piece of Othello's post-war occupation. In the early years of Reconstruction, Douglas did settle into what he called a new vocation, full of advantages mentally and pecuniarily. He was still very much sought after as a lecturer, usually accruing $100 per night. His most common speech was "Self-Made Men," crafted first before the war, and now in frequent demand after the conflict. But Douglas's subjects were also very much about Reconstruction, the nature of the races, freedmen's rights, especially suffrage, and the increasing violence against blacks in the South. He also sought and received invitations to speak in Washington, D.C., at the center of the political tempest over Reconstruction. He missed his newspaper, but he now had easy access as a writer to several national journals, such as The Atlantic, The North American Review, and The Independent. Douglas saw Reconstruction and its unprecedented challenges as a continuation of the purpose of the war, a sacred responsibility to the Union dead and to 4 million freed slaves. He also began to take a particular interest in American foreign affairs, especially in how a new United States, his nation now, might export its emancipationist vision to the Caribbean and elsewhere. The old abolitionist was now a nationalist and an emerging internationalist. Douglas's vision of Reconstruction fell squarely into the radical Republican camp. Especially after congressional Republicans locked horns in political and ideological warfare by 1866 with President Andrew Johnson for control of policy, Douglas grasped how radicalism, far from being odious, is now the popular passport to power. He believed the establishment of a new order in the South, especially the protection of the freedmen's rights, had to be done by activist, interventionist federal power. Douglas advocated what he called something like a despotic central government to vanquish as much as possible the tradition of states' rights. In a statement that went to the heart of the eternal American dilemma with federalism, the new doctrine of human rights, he maintained, could not prevail while there remained such an idea as the right of each state to control its own local affairs. This old radical had found his own passport to power. Douglas believed slavery itself still lurked everywhere in the South, and like an incipient disease, it would infect all aspects of life, if not once and for all, killed. He saw Reconstruction, as he had the war, through an apocalyptic historical lens. The fiery conflict had made possible the national regeneration and entire purification of the country, he wrote in 1866. But only if authority and power were exercised on the defeated South to render the deadly yuppas, root and branch, leaf and fiber, body and sap, utterly destroyed. Douglas wanted the former Confederacy occupied and remade, but the former slaves as the central agents of a political and social revolution. In the early stage of the process, he nurtured the liberal faith that the franchise could protect the freed people from the coming retribution of the white South. His was a vision of the war and Reconstruction as redemptive tragedy, not unlike Herman Melville's 1866 plea. Let us pray that the terrible historic tragedy of our time may not have been enacted without instructing our whole beloved country through pity and terror. While Melville wrote with bereaved wonderment about the scale of the tragedy and the harrowing tasks of Reconstruction, Douglas exuded a millennial hope. To him, the war had been an impressive teacher, an instructor, and in the end, society is instructed. But this moral sense of history had to be enacted in policy and against formidable foes. Douglas learned this quickly about the new president, Andrew Johnson, and the ex-Confederates the Tennessean enabled. From humble origins, Johnson was a successful stump politician from East Tennessee. He had held nearly every level of political office by the late 1850s, alderman, state representative, congressman, 2 terms as governor, and U.S. senator. Johnson was the only Southern senator from a seceded state who refused to follow his state out of the Union in 1861. In 1862, Lincoln appointed him war governor of Tennessee, hence his symbolic place on the ticket in the president's bid for re-election in 1864. Although he opposed secession, Johnson was, nevertheless, an ardent state's rightist. He shared none of the radical Republicans' expansive conception of federal power, and he was a staunch white supremacist who accepted the end of slavery but could not abide the idea of black civil and political rights. His philosophy toward Reconstruction rested in a slogan, "The Constitution as it is, and the Union as it was." Congress had recessed shortly after Johnson was sworn in after Lincoln's death. So during virtually all of the rest of 1865, the new president's lenient, rapid, presidential, and largely pro-Southern approach dominated what historian John Hope Franklin once called Reconstruction, Confederate style. By September, when Douglas gave his speech in Baltimore about humane education and the nature of racism, Johnson had initiated a generous policy of pardons to ex-Confederates. Johnson also returned a good deal of confiscated and abandoned lands to their former white owners in the South. While he also did his best to thwart the work of the Freedmen's Bureau, the agency established to provide rations to hundreds of thousands of black and white war refugees, as well as adjudicate new labor contracts for freedmen. In December, as Congress reconvened, Johnson declared Reconstruction complete 8 months after Appomattox. The former states of the Confederacy had all drafted new constitutions and passed a wide array of black codes, restricting freedmen's lives. It seemed to many, Douglas certainly, that blacks were being returned to servility, and no one would be held responsible for the war, as many former Confederates were elected to serve in Congress. Hence his fears stated back in May, that if left to their own devices, white Southerners, by unfriendly legislation, could make our liberty a delusion, a mockery. At Baltimore in September, he warned about the persistent determination of the present executive of the nation to hold and treat us in a degraded relation. Douglas saw Confederate Reconstruction coming, but was still shocked by its brazen effrontery. Congressional Republicans called an immediate halt to presidential Reconstruction in late 1865 and early 1866. Congress devised the Joint Committee on Reconstruction with 15 members, 12 of whom were Republicans, which in January and February conducted extraordinary public hearings to investigate the conditions on the ground in the South. These unprecedented hearings heard the testimony of 144 witnesses, including Union Army officers and Freedmen's Bureau agents. The ex-Confederates included none other than Robert E. Lee himself and former Vice President Alexander H. Stephens, who offered a defense of secession and states' rights. The overwhelming message of the hearings, especially from federal military and civilian personnel, was that martial law, Union troops, and the Freedmen's Bureau were all dire necessities to quell violence and restore social order. Freedmen's Bureau agents reported over and again about violence against ex-slaves, including whippings, ritualistic torture, and murders. One described huge problems negotiating wage contracts with unwilling planters, the general hatred of the freedmen. Typical of Union officers' testimony was that of General Clifton B. Fisk, who had spent the war and its aftermath in Tennessee and Kentucky. He traveled incognito from plantation to plantation, talking to planters and Negroes in their quarters. Fisk had seen slaveholders and returned rebel soldiers persecute the freedmen, pursue them with vengeance, and burn down their dwellings and schoolhouses. The Joint Committee concluded that allowing ex-Confederates to rule in their former states had been a policy of madness and folly, and called for major legislation that would provide adequate safeguards for social order and freedmen's rights. Later that spring and early summer, this seismic shift in Reconstruction policy and politics led to the passage of a new Freedmen's Bureau bill, the first Civil Rights Act of American history, and the 14th Amendment. In the midst of the hearings and the standoff between President and Congress, various groups of black men came to Washington to lobby the legislature for their rights. Some were denied entry to the galleries, much less the halls of lobbying. In a letter to Senator Charles Sumner, signed by Douglas and his son Lewis, among many other black leaders, they declared that out of self-respect, they would not consent to be colonized in the U.S. Capitol. Douglas led a delegation of 13 men, 12 black, including Lewis, and one white, to the White House for an extraordinary meeting with Johnson. They were not invited, but inspired by the Republican resurgence in the Capitol, they insisted on an audience with the chief executive. George T. Downing of Washington, D.C., shared the leadership and presentation with Douglas. The two had planned this effort to confront Johnson since mid-January, although Lewis played a key role as well in corresponding with the various members. Downing, a former successful hotel owner and caterer, current manager of the House of Representatives dining room, led off with a prepared statement in which the group declared the 13th Amendment insufficient. Speaking for all black Americans, they demanded their rights as citizens and equality before law. Above all, they insisted on being fully enfranchised throughout the land. Then Douglas stepped forward with formal deference. But unmistakably, he invoked Johnson's noble and humane predecessor as he demanded the ballot with which to save ourselves. Whether he fully knew it or not, by his choice of words, Douglas stoked Johnson's anger and deepest prejudices, baiting him with what had to seem false respect. In the order of divine providence, you, Johnson, are placed in a position where you have the power to save or destroy us, to bless or blast us. Johnson's rambling replies stand as perhaps the worst exchange an American president ever conducted in person with African American leaders. The president took the bait in his 45-minute speech. Johnson self-righteously declared himself ready to be the Moses of the freed people. One can only imagine Douglas's thoughts as he sat across the room from the president, less than a year after Appomattox, and heard him declare, "The feelings of my own heart have been for the colored man. I have owned slaves and bought slaves, but I never sold one." For the moment, Douglas and his colleagues suppressed both laughter and outrage. Then Johnson complained that in his relationship to blacks, "I have been their slave instead of their being mine. Some even followed me here, while others are occupying my property with my consent." If the sanctimonious Tennessean had not offended his guests enough, he then threw a jab right at Douglas. He did not like being arraigned, Johnson spouted, by some who can get up handsomely rounded periods and deal in rhetoric, and talk about abstract ideas of liberty. The president brandished his fear of race war if his guests pursued their goals, coldly rebuked Douglas's advocacy of black suffrage, and suggested that colonization was still the best option for the freed people. Douglas felt thrown back in time as though history had stopped somewhere before 1861. Douglas tried to respectfully interrupt the host's obfuscating rejection of voting rights, but Johnson quickly stopped him with, "I am not quite through." The president urged Douglas to consider the plight of poor non-slaveholding whites, arguing that during slavery, the colored man and his master combined to keep him, the poor white, in slavery. Addressing Douglas directly, Johnson asked, "Have you ever lived on a plantation?" "I have, Your Excellency," replied the former slave. As Douglas tried to engage in a colloquy, Johnson pursued him with a nearly non-stop barrage. The guest had to listen as the president declared the abolition of slavery merely an incident to the suppression of the rebellion and predicted a war of the races if blacks got access to the ballot. Worse, Johnson insisted that nothing could ever be forced upon the majority of a community without their consent. When Douglas objected to this defense of states' rights doctrine, remarking, "That was said before the war," Johnson shot back angrily, "I am now talking about a principle, a fundamental tenet in my creed that the people must be obeyed." Then the leader of the country asked the former slave, "Is there anything wrong or unfair in that?" To which Douglas, according to the stenographer, smiled and replied, "A great deal wrong, Mr. President, with all respect." With derision in each man's demeanor, Douglas and Johnson then continued a tense, fruitless give-and-take for several minutes longer, the president making it clear he intended to have no debate, and Douglas equally clear that he would not back down. Before leading the delegation out of the room, Douglas staked out a position. He reminded Johnson that if black life and liberty were left to the whims of Southern whites, the freedmen would be divested of all political power. Douglas summed up their impasse to Johnson's face. "The very thing Your Excellency would avoid in the Southern states can only be avoided by the very measure that we propose." The meeting could hardly have ended in a worse manner. If the black delegation felt disgusted, Johnson was livid. According to Johnson's private secretary, the president no more expected that darky delegation yesterday than he did the cholera. As the secretary reported to the New York World after the black delegation left the room at the White House, Johnson declared, "Those damned sons of bitches thought they had me in a trap. I know that damned Douglas. He's just like any nigger, and he would sooner cut a white man's throat than not." Douglas met many presidents. Sobering as it was, he may have perversely held Johnson's epithets as a badge of honor. Before the day was over, the delegation met with a group of Republican congressmen for a debriefing and signed a public response to Johnson. Drafted by the elder Douglas, dictated to Lewis, the statement did not mince words. It called Johnson's elaborate speech entirely unsound and prejudicial. The group rejected the president's stance against black enfranchisement on the grounds of old hatreds between poor whites and former slaves. Blame for such animosity lay with white masters, argued the black leaders. They divided both to conquer each. They told Johnson they would not back down under any circumstances, reminding him, in one of Douglas's old abolitionist maxims, that men are whipped oftenest who are whipped easiest. Finally, they unequivocally denounced Johnson's embrace of colonization as a discredited, pro-slavery theory of human degradation. As Douglas looked about for that new vacation in the wake of the war, he quickly realized that the revolution of emancipation had only begun. In the epic contest over Reconstruction policy in Washington, he discovered his new raison d'etre. It was not unlike his career as he had always known it. "I soon found," he later wrote in an understatement, "that the Negro had still a cause, and that he needed my voice and pen to plead for it." Before the end of the year and into 1867, Douglas took a remarkable speech on the road, Sources of Danger to the Republic. In cities from Brooklyn to St. Louis, Douglas skewered Johnson as an unmitigated calamity and a disgrace the country must stagger under. So fearful of the situation was the orator that he went so far as to recommend a major constitutional revision, eliminating the president's veto and pardon powers, as well as the vice presidency itself. These measures reflect as much his visceral hatred for Johnson as prudent constitutional thinking. But Douglas did leave a timeless maxim for republics. Our government may at some time be in the hands of a bad man. When in the hands of a good man, it is all well enough. We ought to have our government so shaped that even when in the hands of a bad man, we shall be safe. A full 25 years into his public life, Douglas seemed to have realized yet again the nature of his only true weapon, words, spoken and written. Increasingly now, he wanted to get to the center of American political life, Washington, D.C., and if possible, inside the circle of Republican Party leaders. He sought more lecture opportunities in the Capitol, spoke on political subjects, especially stressing the all-important matter of black suffrage. He cultivated growing friendships with congressmen and senators such as Charles Sumner, as well as with Chief Justice Salmon Chase. As a matter of livelihood, Douglas still conducted long, back-breaking lecture tours all over the country. Reconstruction was for Douglas the new cause, not unlike the old abolition crusade. The revolution of Union victory and black emancipation could still be lost or won. Douglas made no real distinction between Johnson's white supremacy and slavery itself. A constant refrain in his post-war rhetoric was his assertion that slavery is not abolished until the black man has the ballot. In this reasoning, as long as Johnson controlled Reconstruction, the war was not over. The slave power endured, Douglas believed, in the handful of conservative Republicans and the droves of Democrats who supported Johnson's efforts to thwart the crucial legislation brewing up from radical Republicans in Congress. In a private letter to Sumner, Douglas drew his line clearly. Former slaveholders should never be trusted to legislate about black rights. Until redeemers come from the pit instead of paradise, until the temperance cause can be left to rumsellers, until the morals of society can be safely committed to the care of those who habitually outrage all the decencies of life, the freedmen cannot be safely left to the care of their former masters. The revolution was unfinished. Douglas's grueling travel and lecture schedule in 1866 may not have allowed him to follow as closely as he might have the great debates in Congress over passage of the Civil Rights Act in April and the 14th Amendment in June. Invitations poured in to speak all over the North. Douglas's son, Charles, and daughter, Rosetta, living in Rochester, tried frustratingly to keep up with their father's whereabouts as they processed his correspondence during 1866 to 67. Itineraries indicate that on the 2 days after the White House meeting with President Johnson, Douglas spoke in Philadelphia and Baltimore, respectively. 4 days after that, February 13th, he was back in Washington lecturing, followed by 5 consecutive days in Pittsburgh, and then immediately by a full week of engagements out in Illinois, where he spoke in the State House in Springfield. Through bone-numbing travel by railroad, he was again speaking back in Washington, D.C. and its environs on March 6th through 10th. The orator had hardly lost his occupation. He emerged in 1866 and 1867 as one of the most prominent itinerant spokesmen of freedmen's rights and the radical Republican effort to shape Reconstruction. Douglas's newly achieved enemies were well aware of the former abolitionist's effective voice in the national political arena. It would have pleased Douglas to know how much correspondence arrived at the White House condemning him for his well-publicized confrontation with Johnson. A former Democratic Party cabinet official, William L. Hodge, applauded Johnson's resistance to Douglas's impudence and attempt to cram the Negro wool and all down our throats. Another Democrat, James H. Embry, monitored the Black Orator's speech in Philadelphia on February 9th. Referring to him only as Fred Douglas, Embry said the speaker was grossly insulting and abusive, and gave loose rein to satire, anger, and slander. Commenting especially on how blacks and whites had shared the same platform in proximity, Embry nevertheless told Johnson not to worry. The speech was only important as being the utterance of his friends in Washington, and he merely the mask behind which they strike. Douglas would not have been flattered by the racist accusation sent to Johnson by a more humble Michigan supporter, complimenting the president. "You was more than a match for the great Fred Douglas. Many fanatics think their pet Douglas is far ahead of your excellency in profound wisdom." By March, administration friends wrote to warn the president and his aides that Douglas was coming back to Washington to excite the Negroes to rebel. By May, Some Democrats called Johnson's argument that black suffrage would stimulate race war, put forth to the February black delegation, your Douglas argument. These letters provide a glimpse into a kind of 19th century parlor racism. If the old abolitionist needed a new occupation, he surely had one now. The frightening black man with brains, who had penetrated the racist psyches of powerful people with words and his physical presence. Although none had dispatched him to the hustings as their mask, and he felt like no one's pet, Douglas had more allies among Republicans than he realized. Lyman Trumbull, a moderate Republican senator from Illinois, had been a principal author of the Confiscation Acts and the 13th Amendment. Now, Trumbull crafted the new Freedmen's Bureau Bill and the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Douglas never developed a close relationship with Trumbull, whose political allegiances varied over time. Although both measures contained elements that disappointed radicals, Douglas saw their enormous potential to his cause. The renewal of the Freedmen's Bureau over Johnson's veto brought hope to insecure former slaves in the South. The Civil Rights Act, which passed by a two-thirds vote in Congress on April 9th, overriding the president's veto, was a remarkable departure in federal power and in central government-state relations. It did not include political rights, to Douglas's chagrin, but it created national citizenship for all persons, except Indians, born in the United States, and it identified some fundamental rights, as Trumbull put it, newly guaranteed to every man as a free man. Those rights included elements of contract law and protection of free labor. The law also stipulated that cases of discrimination were to be heard in federal and not state courts, although it lacked precision on how such a process would be adjudicated. Moreover, the law was vague in that it largely addressed public and not private acts of injustice. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 was, above all, the first effort to breathe meaning and enforcement into the 13th Amendment. Johnson's strident veto message, laced with a staunch states' rights position against all manner of centralization of power in the federal government, as well as with blatant white supremacy, invoking fears of racial intermarriage, caused a permanent break between the executive and the legislature, and set the stage for 2 years of constitutional crisis. Johnson even claimed that to extend the rights of blacks would discriminate against whites. He considered such expansion of civil rights fraught with evil and made to operate in favor of the colored and against the white race, a set of notions some white Americans still cling to in the 21st century. When Douglas lampooned Johnson out on the stump, he did so with good reasons. Douglas did not develop strong ties with John Bingham or Thaddeus Stevens in the House of Representatives. Bingham was the principal author of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, and Stevens, the most radical among the Republican architects of Reconstruction policy, and often its House floor manager. Bingham was a Christian abolitionist and Ohio congressman who had served as a judge advocate in the Union Army, as well as on the commission that tried the conspirators in the Lincoln assassination in 1865. He had entered Congress in 1854. His political career was a deep reflection of the anti-slavery history of the Republican Party. He believed the liberation of the slaves had forced the United States to federalize the Bill of Rights and apply it to all Americans. Bingham considered the rights of citizenship the same as the sacred rights of human nature. Stevens, too, embraced equality. The Pennsylvanian, already 74 years old and soon to die in 1868, imagined Reconstruction as a movement to rebuild a shattered empire, to plant deep and solid the cornerstone of eternal justice, and to erect thereon a superstructure of perfect equality of every human being before the law. Inadvertently, Bingham and Douglas agreed on all the basics of Reconstruction. They employed similar apocalyptic rhetoric, as well as the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution, honed in abolitionist circles during the 1850s. The new cast-iron dome of the U.S. Capitol was now completed to full majesty when Bingham stood in the House chamber on January 25th, 1866, and introduced the 14th Amendment. He insisted that the war had made the amendment necessary, though not without sorrow, not without martyrdom, not without storm and tempest and fire running along the ground. He insisted that the federal government enforce equality, not merely as an abstraction, but in the states. In the states. Douglas closely followed the congressional debates and the Joint Committee's hearings and its report in the press that winter. In language so similar to that Douglas had used ever since Appomattox, he observed Johnson's anti-coercive policy, characterized as matchless wickedness, and tantamount to the surrender by Grant to Lee. Douglas applauded Bingham's forceful denunciations of states' rights doctrines and his assertion of the national authority to enforce equality before law. Had Douglas attended congressional sessions, he would have relished Bingham's condemnation of opponents of the amendment as conspirators and prodigal rebels, their northern allies as traitors whose hands are red with the blood of murder and assassination, who for 4 years struck at the life of its, the government's, defenders. Such words were political music in Douglas's ears. During the first 6 months of 1866, Republicans faced several great challenges. Three of them they met straight on in settled terms: defining citizenship, repudiation of Confederate war debts, including any claims to compensation for loss of slave property, and disqualification of ex-Confederates from office holding. But three others remained historically unresolved and made the 14th Amendment limited and controversial, though revolutionary. They did not settle the extent of the right to vote for black men and left women out of suffrage altogether. They did not give precision to the extent of civil rights made equal before law. And they struggled to reapportion representation of the slave seats given the southern states under the Three-Fifths Clause. But Bingham's Section 1 of the 14th Amendment was something Douglas could embrace as a talisman. It was emancipation etched in parchment, enduring to this day as the most influential and far-reaching constitutional result of the Civil War. It attempted, on the matter of individual civil rights, to make the United States one body of people, equal before law, and not subject to local or state practice. At least in law, after embittered debate, when the amendment passed the Senate on June 8th by 33-11, and the House by 138-36, a second constitution in America was born. Despite the myriad uses and abuses of the 14th Amendment over time, and endless conservative attempts to thwart its egalitarianism, it is always worth remembering the enactment's immediate roots. Without the liberation of 4 million slaves, Section 1 could never have been enshrined into America's legal DNA in the 19th century. Its two careful sentences are a resounding answer to the ghost-like language of Roger Taney in the Dred Scott case. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Section 1 was a dream come true for old abolitionists, but as an adamant advocate of universal black male suffrage, Douglas found elements in Section 2 of the 14th Amendment that led him to oppose it during the coming year. Black suffrage was still the greatest obstacle, even for radical Republicans. Indeed, the 14th Amendment contains sufficient ambiguity, especially about voting rights, that some radicals opposed its ratification. Section 2 addressed suffrage, but extended the right to vote directly to no one. It stipulated that for whatever number of males denied the right to vote in a given state, that state's representation in Congress would be reduced in proportion. The measure represented one of the hard-won but awkward compromises that made passage of the amendment possible in the ideological hurricane of 1866. As Douglas barnstormed across the country from Rochester to Washington and out to Illinois prairie towns and back again from February until April 1866, he ferociously attacked Johnson and the conservatives. His ridicule of the president was so aggressive that occasionally a venue would refuse to allow his speech, and some groups protested his appearances. He wished that the status of blacks might be settled by Reconstruction legislation. But the nation, he feared, would now leave in the soil some root or fiber out of which may spring other rebellions and other assassinations, like Lincoln's. If he were a minister of the gospel, Douglas told a Washington audience, he would preach for 6 months from one text, Remember Lot's Wife. The story in Genesis chapters 18 to 19 is about God's awesome power to cause hopeful beginnings as well as dreadful endings by retributive justice. For their many sins, Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed by God, raining brimstone and fire down on them. But Lot and his family are alerted to flee, then rescued and saved in the mountains, excepting Lot's wife, who, warned not to look backward at the devastation, disobeys and is instantly consumed into a pillar of salt. On the morning after, Abraham, patriarch of the whole biblical tradition, stands on the mountain and surveys the plain smoldering below in utter ruin. But Lot and his daughters are saved, because God remembered Abraham, as he had also remembered Noah after the flood. For Douglas, the Old Testament was a template of pliant stories and historical lessons. In this case, the orator used the image of Abraham looking down upon the destroyed landscape to demand that Americans look down upon their own recent self-destruction and all but unjustified survival and remember. Desperately, Douglas announced, he would show that nations should have memories. As the biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann contends, this story makes us see the destruction we have ourselves caused, to know it, feel it, and remember it. With Abraham, we can then know something urgent about God's call to us. In 1866 to 67, Douglas demanded resistance to Johnson and his minions. Repeatedly, he urged the victorious North to hear the call of remembrance. Frederick Douglass on the president's policy, shouted a broadside announcing the orator's speech at the assembly rooms on Louisiana Avenue in Washington on March 10th. Here Douglass faced an audience he relished. It included the radical Pennsylvania Congressman William D. Kelly, Senators Richard Yates of Illinois and Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, and especially General Oliver O. Howard, the director of the Freedmen's Bureau. This was the kind of political power center he sought. Douglas delivered a fierce defense of the integrity of the Negro. Contrary to predictions, they would never die out, despite ubiquitous images of them for white eyes at the mercy of the lash, the bloodhound, and the auction block. Blacks had risen from the depths of generations of enslavement to the heights of respectability, and hence the nation was honor-bound to give them the franchise. Only the vote could provide self-protection. With considerable humor and a good deal of sarcasm, wrote a reporter, Douglas pilloried Johnson for his racist contradictions expressed in their White House meeting. The chief executive's anxieties about race mixing, said the former slave, ought to be assuaged, since the white man and the Negro agreed well within Douglas's own blood. What shall be said of Andrew Johnson? Douglas asked. Better, he concluded, to leave Mr. Johnson speak for himself, as being the most damaging thing he can do. The president had promised to be the Moses of the colored race, but was readily becoming their Pharaoh. Then Douglas tested the limits of propriety, saying that Johnson need not fear physical assassination from blacks. That would add nothing to the refinements of society. Instead, they only intended his moral assassination. Over the summer of 1866, Douglas joined forces with old abolitionist friends Gerrit Smith and Wendell Phillips and openly opposed the 14th Amendment on the grounds that it did not explicitly provide black suffrage. As the pivotal fall congressional elections loomed, the Republicans were deeply divided on the question of black voting rights. Thaddeus Stevens, who was a complex mixture of idealism and pragmatic politics, urged caution on suffrage, knowing that the vast majority of white Northerners, even Republicans, would not welcome political equality for blacks any more than they would social equality. Northern votes and control of Congress against Johnson's conservative coalition were at stake. But in this instance, Douglas's own hard-earned sense of political pragmatism dissipated. He simply could not countenance citizenship without the right to vote. In July, he made the case in the National Anti-Slavery Standard that he had made on so many platforms. Equal citizenship, he said, without the franchise, was but an empty name. To say that I am a citizen to pay taxes, obey laws, and fight the battles of the country, but in all that respects voting and representation, I am but as so much inert matter, is to insult my manhood. In 1866 to 67, Douglas's political sensibilities careened between exhilaration and outrage. Douglas also grew discouraged at the constant news of mob violence emanating from the South. Nothing tarnished the theory at the heart of political liberalism, that the vote could protect people, quite like the horrific riots/massacres in Memphis, May 1st to 13th, and in New Orleans, July 30th to 31st. The black population of Memphis had quadrupled during the year since the war. Hundreds of freedmen and black soldiers were now a very visible part of the city's life. When two horse-drawn hacks collided, one driven by a white man and the other a black, and black troops intervened, violence exploded for 3 days. White mobs attacked black communities. When the smoke cleared, 48 people were dead, all but two black. 5 black women were raped, and African-American houses and churches, as well as Freedmen's Bureau schools, torched. In the Crescent City, a new radical legislature and a public procession of some 200 black supporters, many of whom were former Union soldiers, tried to assemble. But city police, led by Confederate veterans, attacked the gathering, and gun battles broke out in the streets. Delegates and allies were shot down as they attempted to leave the convention hall under cover of white flags. The New Orleans bloodbath left 34 blacks and 3 white radicals dead, and at least 100 more wounded. The recalcitrant white South had risen with the vengeance Douglas had predicted. In August, the National Union Convention met in Philadelphia to rally around Johnson's policies. As a symbol of the sectional reunion that Johnson wanted to declare accomplished, the South Carolina ex-Confederate senator and current governor, James L. Orr, and former Union general Darius N. Couch walked into the convention arm in arm. Appalled by this display of obeisance to the former Confederate states, and against the backdrop of broad public awareness of anti-black violence, Republicans decided to convene their own counter-convention of Southern Loyalists in Philadelphia. Hundreds of Northern Republicans attended as honorary delegates, including Douglas, who was unexpectedly elected by fellow party members in Rochester. Demonstrating the depth of Republican squeamishness about black suffrage and the delicacy of the fall elections, none other than Thaddeus Stevens had urged Rochesterites not to send Douglas. Flouting Stevens or anyone else arguing that a black leader should remain invisible at this juncture, Douglas departed Rochester with a public statement. If this convention will receive me, the event will certainly be somewhat significant progress. If they reject me, they will only identify themselves with another convention, Johnson's. Douglas knew there was more than one way to wave a bloody shirt. Douglas's presence at the convention was the subject of controversy even before he arrived in Philadelphia. Aboard a train somewhere between Harrisburg and Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a group of fellow delegates from Western and Southern states approached him, expressed their very high respect, and then urged him not to attend the convention. The scene on that train car was one among many Douglas remembered as an autobiographer. It told something revealing about both his life and the country. He felt like the Jonah of the Republican ship, he recalled, and responsible for the contrary winds and misbehaving weather. Among the group waiting upon him was the widely esteemed governor of Indiana, Oliver P. Morton. The chief spokesman making the awkward appeal was a New Orleanian with a very French name that Douglas could not recall. The undesirableness of a black man's presence, the group argued, was dictated by Northern racial prejudice. In the fall elections, these Republicans believed they must dodge the cry of social and political equality sure to be raised against them. In Life and Times, Douglas purported to remember verbatim his reply to the polite visitors. "Gentlemen, With all respect, you might as well ask me to put a loaded pistol to my head and blow my brains out as to ask me to keep out of this convention. He remembered gleefully warning his detractors that should they persist